Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to Monster X Radio. It is November 10th, 2013, and we got another great guest lined up for you tonight. I'm your host, Johnny Bigfoot, and with me tonight is Shane Corson. How you doing tonight, buddy?
Doing awesome, man. Really jived about tonight's show.
Very nice, very nice. And I guess without further ado, would you like to introduce our guest of the evening?
Yeah, absolutely. Our guest tonight is a well-respected colleague amongst the Bigfoot community, a multifaceted entrepreneur who has created and runs the online site, the Bigfoot Lunch Club, and who also is the mastermind behind the Portland, Oregon-based Hop Squatch events, to which myself have I've attended many of them and absolutely love. And for those that may not know our guest tonight, Guy Edwards, he is also the creator of the intriguing concept of the entitled The Five Stages of the Bigfoot Announcement, which is almost everybody uses nowadays as far as interpreting a Bigfoot announcement, especially of the hoaxing variety. So without further ado, let's welcome in Guy Edwards. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Appreciate being on the show. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, likewise, Guy. Really stoked you took the time to join us tonight. Glad to have you aboard here. And, having said that, a lot of people online know you, and a lot of people in the Bigfoot community know you. A lot of our guests, may not know you. So do you mind just telling us a little bit about what got you into the Bigfoot community in general, what got you started?
It kind of starts, and let me tell you how I got into Bigfoot in the first place. Before I really joined the community, I probably got involved in the community close to like 2007, but I've been into Bigfoot since I was in the second grade. We had this book in our public school library that on the inside cover, they had that Patterson-Gimlin frame 352 frame. And for some reason, I felt like Bigfoot was looking through that camera, through time, just at me. And as a 8-year-old kid, I felt possessed that I needed to figure out what was going on, why this captured everybody's imagination. And moving forward about a couple more years, my parents belonged to the Good Sam Camping Club, and so we'd go camping at a new spot every month. And until then, Bigfoot was kind of like my secret, because when I saw Bigfoot, it was in those Time Life mystery books. So I knew that Bigfoot was in the same kind of the category as the Loch Ness Monster, Bermuda Triangle, aliens, conspiracies. And so I knew that even as a young kid that these were kind of fringe topics. So I didn't want anybody to take away Bigfoot from me, so I kept it to myself. And then one of these times when we went camping, to this day I wish I could remember where it was, somewhere in Oregon, this guy had built a chair for a 9-foot Sasquatch. And he took us out to his barn, and me and my family and everybody else that was part of the Good Sam Camping Club, and he had some casts all lined up against the wall, but you couldn't ignore this chair. It looked like kind of, it's so bulky and so big and square, it almost looked, it was creepy because it looked like an executioner's chair almost, it was wide enough on the handles where he could actually keep a mason jar that he would pour apple juice in it every night. And this mason jar was definitely too small for a deer to get his head into, but he says every morning he'd come out there and the apple juice was drank. So he would tell us, what I would think, stories that I thought the adults would, like, laugh at or scoff at or whatever. And when I saw that my parents and their peers were definitely just as interested, they were all campers in the Northwest, then I felt like even though Bigfoot was my thing, I felt like that there might be some kind of a legitimate aspect to cult people in general that might think this is something that's intriguing. So when I was working, fast forward to about 7 years ago, I kind of revisited my passion for Bigfoot, and I was, going online, and at the time, there wasn't a lot of websites out there. There was the BFRO and a handful of others, but nothing that was really pulling everybody together. There was the Bigfoot forums, too. So I wanted to kind of create something that allowed me to get the latest Bigfoot news for myself. And so when I did Bigfoot Lunch Club for the first few years, it was really for me to kind of catalog all the, like, it was basically me collecting news clippings, right? So whenever there was something out there, a news, local news station or whatever was talking about Bigfoot, I would collect that news clipping and put it on my blog, and it was, what ended up happening is people started subscribing to it. People started visiting, and I started meeting people that were pretty big in the Bigfoot field, like Tom Powell and Cliff Berrickman and so forth, and eventually, now I've met most of the guys, Bob Gimlin, all the second generation people like Larry Lund and Joe Bilart, so So Bigfoot Lunch Club at first was just for me, but it ended up being such a, you know, popular thing for other people. You know, there was about three strong years where I was, you know, really trying to feed everything to people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it in a nutshell of how it started and kind of, you know, where I am, you know, where I was, you know, as far as a year ago. I've been slowing down on Bigfoot Lunch Club, but I've been doing also these hopscotches this year.
Yeah, I mean, the Bigfoot Lunch Club, I mean, I follow religiously, and I know a lot of people online do as well. You know, it's one of those avenues that you can go to for just some of the best information out there, or just, you know, a good laugh sometimes. You post a lot of funny things on there. But the hopscotch events, you know, I've attended them and was amazed at just what you put together with the hopscotch events. Who you could bring into those events, and just the amount of information and just the camaraderie that came from those, man. I mean, I was overwhelmed actually when I first went to the first one because of the amount of you know, not big names per se, but just the amount of it was just like a beer and, you know, Bigfoot talk gathering. It was just so, it was like walking into a really homely house, and that was.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's how it felt, you know. It wasn't like you're walking to, like, the seminar and you had to sit down and shut up and be quiet. And no, it was really welcoming, and, you know, after the fact, you can get up and talk to everybody, and, you know, I met a lot of interesting people that day that that I've wanted to meet, and some that I never thought I would ever meet. And, you know, that was, you know, something you put together, and you're continuing doing this. I mean, it's not like it's a one-time deal or a two-time deal. You know, this is a really cool event.
We're going to do the last one for this year, this month, on the fourth Sunday of this month. And but this is something that's going to be ongoing. And, you know, it's great to hear that kind of feedback, because I'm really proud of what, you know, what I was trying to do is I was trying to make it so, you know, one of the things that I noticed is that, you know, people in Ohio and Texas and, you know, who are Bigfooters, and, you know, bless them for being so aggressive, but they have such good tight-knit communities, and they have, you know, these bigger organizations, and I really wanted the Northwest to have the same type of thing. And I think one of the reasons why we don't have one publicly is because we have such a close group privately, right? I mean, all these Bigfooters, you know, hang out with each other, you know, every other weekend. And, you know, and we're pretty inclusive group. So, you know, you could end up, you know, on any one of these evenings when we all decide to get together to have, you know, 20 or 30 people, you know, spontaneously get together and just, you know, chat things up. There's quite a few people that, you know, met up before Bobcat did his movie the other night, you know, where we all met ahead of time, you know, and got together before we actually watched the movie.
Yeah.
So that's what Hopscotch was about, though. I wanted to make sure that, you know, that we kept in touch, but I'm also trying to, you know, bring things to the table that I think it's real easy for any of us to like our own ideas, and I think that's great. I think everybody has their own perspective, but I think there's something that we can learn from other people that we may not necessarily agree with even, you know. And so Hopscotch is kind of like that environment where, you know, we can have biologists and aliens and tree people all kind of talk at the same time and find out where we overlap, because I think there's value to everything. I mean, you know, what if everybody had their own experiences, but then we learned that, you know, Bigfoot's always hanging out, you know, 3 yards away from water, and we should be, you know, camping there. You know, you can find that out no matter whether you think Bigfoot is a psychic or spirit or ghost or whatever. You know, if we all came together and, you know, kind of compared notes, we probably come closer to, you know, understanding what Bigfoot's all about.
Does this take place in Portland then?
Yeah, it does. It takes place usually on the fourth Sunday of every month. It's definitely going to be the fourth Sunday this month. We do it at the Lucky Labrador off of Hawthorne. Next year I'm going to try and get the Lucky Labrador in the Northwest. It's a little bit bigger venue. I think Shane went to that one when we went to the Northwest one.
Yeah, that was quite the event, though. You had quite a few. Well, it was actually the day after the Falcon Project.
Right.
So you had Munz and everybody there, and so yeah, you needed a bigger venue because it was packed.
Yeah. I think the capacity of that place was 150, and I think we're real close to that. So we couldn't have any more people even if we wanted to. And that was kind of the type of thing that I want to do. Where even though there was a lot of people, it still felt pretty intimate, and we could get these experts up there to kind of give their perspective. And I was fortunate to be able to get also John Bindernagel was there as well.
Yeah.
And it was a great thing. And so next year I'm gonna make some adjustments and do something that's kind of a hybrid, between my biggest event that I had and then some of the more intimate ones. As a matter of fact, this one we're actually doing a Bigfoot psychic or an interspecies communicator, depending on kind of the label you want to give it. This is a Native American lady who is not heavy duty in the Bigfoot community, which I think is has some kind of value, or has a lot of value, because I think we all kind of make adjustments as we hang out in the community longer. And we kind of, I always like to bring people in that may not have the same type of assumptions that we have in the community anymore. So it kind of gives us all opportunities as Bigfooters listening to someone who's interested in Bigfoot but not necessarily in the community to kind of give us a fresh perspective.
Yeah, I agree with that. I may disagree with some of the people that go to these events, but they definitely, every time I've gone, and I've gone to most of them, they bring some new perspective to it. Like I said, I don't always agree with them. But like I said, it's a coffee house sort of, it's that sort of environment where you can just sit down and, listen to what they have to say and then talk to them afterwards. It's really nice. And I really look forward to more of these events. And kudos to you to bring this to the Pacific Northwest. Just like you said, we all get in our little groups and go out and do stuff together, but the general public and those that are interested or have information that, you won't find anywhere else can now come to these events and share. And, we in fact learn a lot from them. So that's awesome, man.
Well, I appreciate that. And that is one of the, when these events happen and I see a new face and I've brought someone outside of the, community into our events and kind of have, I think that's, that's what I want to do. I think that's one of the, best things that we could do for Bigfooting is have, a lot of people who don't know much about Bigfoot, it's amazing how many assumptions that they make. One of the biggest ones is they think there's a solitary single Bigfoot out there that we've been trying to find for, the last 50 years when, I tell them that there's probably, there's a whole breeding population probably, but things like that where I think, or they don't realize that, that there's a pretty good anatomy to some of these casts that we have that even though there were some flat wooden ones that were done, some of these other ones actually show some animation, some details. And I think that when other people get a chance to realize there's a little bit more to Bigfooting, than they had thought or assumed, I think it's going to be healthier for us to, get closer to what I think most of us want is the truth about Bigfoot, whatever that truth is. I don't think anybody knows or has a monopoly on it, but I think we all kind of, want to get closer to the truth about Bigfoot. And that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody wants to prove Bigfoot or find Bigfoot. I just think we all want to know what the truth of it is.
And Guy, speaking of that, I know you're good friends with Cliff Brockman and whatnot, and you've gone out with him many, many times and whatnot. Do you guys kind of share the same concepts and thoughts, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think I think definitely if there's anybody out there that I'm mostly aligned with as far as sharing the same type of model of Bigfoot, it would be Cliff. I think that, he uses some BFRO techniques, that I don't necessarily agree with. But at the same time, you know, what else are you going to do in the woods? I think, you know, I'm not a big fan of wood knocking. I'm not a big fan of doing calling.
I agree.
Because I feel like you know, when you're out there, if Bigfoot's around, Bigfoot already knows you're there. You know, so
right.
I don't think that you need to call them or bring them in or whatever. But as far as, you know, our perception of, you know, of what Bigfoot may be, you know, as far as maybe closer to, you know, sharing an ancestor with the orangutan, being a biological creature, all those things, you know, that's pretty much where I line up. But as you know, Tom Powell is a good friend of mine. Matthew Johnson, I built his website. He's a good friend of mine. These two guys, you know, kind of go in the more paranormal angle. Matthew Johnson has said that you know, they have these kind of a cloaking abilities, and Tom Powell is really into what these guys can do telepathically, and so I think that, you know, I like that I have, you know, friends that have these different ideas. And that we can disagree about it, and we both, like when we talk, like when I talk to Dr. J, Matthew Johnson, or Tom Powell, I think they pretty much know what kind of conversation we're going to have in a certain way, and I think
right.
we want to hear each other. You know, I think in general the community wants to talk more than listen, but when we get together, I think we want to listen. I mean, more recently, probably I don't want to say strangest theory, but the most complex theory I would say that I have heard is my friend Kirk Sigurdsson, who's coming out with a new book called Cultus, which is a story about Bigfoot, where he thinks there's kind of what they used to be called djinns, but we kind of know them better in the modern world as genies, right? But he thinks that there's some kind of these magical creatures that were talked about in the Middle East and happen to be out here taking the form of Bigfoot. So I enjoy that. I think and I feel comfortable enough, you know, with my close friends to telling them that, you know, I don't agree with you, but I do love that theory, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I know Tom really well too, and we disagree on many things, but yeah, at the end of the day, you know, we've talked about this, you know, it's our love, and, you know, because I know Tom, he's passionate. You know, he's invited me out to this place out in Clackamas a few times, and, you know, like I said, he's passionate. You know, we don't agree with some of, you know, our beliefs and whatnot, but at the same time, he's willing to, you know, he's willing to listen to what I have to say. And if he gives me that respect, I'm willing to listen to what he has to say. And, you know, he has a lot more experience in the field than I do. And that I
right.
highly respect, highly respect.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll Cliff, I would say, probably has the most cred as far as being out in the woods more, you know, because, you know, he was a school teacher. And so, you know, so he was out there from, you know, summer break all the time, and then
yeah.
also, you know, whenever they had their vacations, he was out in the woods, and he would go out by himself a lot, you know. But same with Tom Powell, as you know, as Tom's kids got older, you know, because you know Cliff had the advantage of being single without having a family. Tom had his family obligations too, but he pioneered doing camera research on Sasquatch. He had a great, I think he did something for almost 2 full years at this property. It's well documented. You can read about it on Bigfoot Lunch Club or Tom Powell's blog, tomsquatch.com, where he actually, you know, did all these things where you had to build the cameras yourself and then hook them all up to a computer and then, and he did the wiring, all that stuff. So, Tom Powell is one of my more favorite paranormal Bigfooters, even though because he started off teaching Bigfoot initially as a pseudoscience to his students, then got into Bigfoot, then started doing the scientific stuff, and became, you know, for lack of a better term, a Bigfoot believer. And then as he did all the due diligence of doing the hardcore research, being out in the woods, setting up the cameras and stuff like that, it was an accident. It was a total accident how he came into the to the telepathy, or he, as he likes to call it, the coconut telegraph of Bigfoot, where he had what I would say decent evidence that that they were messing with him, you know. And I won't try and retell the story because he tells it better than anybody else. But I would say that, you know, how Tom, to me, if I'm honest, you know, the way he came to the paranormal side of Bigfooting is one of the more, ways that almost makes sense to me. You know, like if I had that kind of evidence, come to me the way it came to him, you know, it would make sense that, you know, I would explore those things a little bit further.
Yeah, I guess it also depends on what your ultimate goal of this is. I mean, you know, is it to prove Bigfoot exists? Because I think some of that cloaking or genie stuff, and it kind of muddies the waters, I think, as far as proving this as a species, you know. I think, you know, we need real science and real tangible evidence, you know, and then maybe we could get to that stuff if we can actually prove something. I mean, I guess it all depends. You'd think, you know, if your goal is to prove it, you might want, you know, you might stay away from that stuff, but these big name people are into it.
Right, you know, I mean, I'm the same way, and that's why I say, you know, at this point, you know, I think the closest we can do is try and find out what the truth of Bigfoot is. In order to have proof, which I would love if we had proof, but I think we need to have a species. We need to have a body, I'm not saying that we need to kill one or find one or whatever like that.
But
at the end of the day, if we want proof, we do have to have a body, and I don't care if we have, you know, a DNA or anything else. We need a full body to do that, and I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I just think that we have to, you know, acknowledge that, you know, and I think, from day one, and, you know, most people know this, like, proving Bigfoot to me is a pretty lofty goal, and I don't know if I'd be the one capable of helping or contributing to that. One of my goals, personal goals, is I just want to know what a Bigfoot face looks like, you know, and if I could see a Bigfoot face, I would be happy, you know, and I would, you know, probably, you know, wash my hands and say I'm done. That was it.
So, Guy, go along with that. You know, let's tell the audience. I mean, what's your opinion? So, are you in the boat that Bigfoot 100% exists, or are you in the boat of it's a possibility?
Oh, you know, that's a tough question because whenever people ask me, you know, I usually give a pretty safe answer, you know, which means that I tell people that I'm a Bigfoot hopeful. I really hope Bigfoot's out there. I've never had an encounter. I've never seen one. I've been out there and heard some strange noises, I've been out there where I felt like, you know, something's creepy going on, but, you know, all I could, you know, it's only as scientific as the hairs on the back of my neck, you know? I think that that's one of the things why I like about Bigfoot is it's not a leprechaun. It's not, you know, a fairy or anything like that. You know what I mean? Like, the whole thing about Bigfoot is Bigfoot is, or more likely than all these other, you know, things in what most people put it in the same category, is actually a biological creature that, you know, that is very plausible that could have, you know, crossed the strait and come over here in the Northwest and be the only primate that's here, that lived here before, you know, the human primate came out here. So,
yeah.
I love the idea that, you know, Bigfoot is absolutely plausible. I'm a Bigfoot hopeful. Until I have my own encounter, you know, I can't say, you know whether or not I fully believe in Bigfoot, you know, but there's no doubt in my mind that there's enough evidence that Bigfoot is worth investigating.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. You know, and I think that, you know, anybody who thinks that, you know, their first instinct about Bigfoot is to look away or just be dismissive about it doesn't know how much evidence there is out there that is so encouraging. So that's my safe answer. You know, I mean, but the bottom line, if you ask any of my family members, from my wife to my in-laws to my nephews, they would call me a full-on Bigfoot believer.
Yeah. Well, you do have the hopscotch events and the Bigfoot Lunch Club, so yeah.
Right. So you know, it depends on how thinly you want to split hairs. But that's one of the things that I love about Bigfoot is that there's not a magical quality, you know, or Bigfoot doesn't require magic to exist, right? I think when you talk about fairies or ghosts or even aliens, requires quite a bit for them to be real. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that any of these things aren't real. I'm just saying that, you know, they require magic. They require something that's other than that we haven't been able to duplicate. You know, and I'm all for imagination and all that stuff. I'm a big, you know, fantasy sci-fi nerd. But I think that Bigfoot is one of those things where, in order for Bigfoot to exist, you don't have to push the envelope of belief too far. You know, it's very plausible that, and becomes more plausible by science every day. You know, I mean, the fact that there was about a period of 2 million years when there was like 6 bipeds living on Earth at the same time. You know, that's something that we didn't know as little as 20 years ago, right? So
mm-hmm.
with finding out about the Homo forensis, the Hobbit, being a small bipedal creature that lived among normal Homo sapiens, and then that kind of opened the door for us to learn that, you know, there were several, you know, bipedal hominids that were existing at the same time for a whole, you know, like modern humans haven't been around for even 1 million years. So, you know, I think you know, 400,000 years or something like that would be what people would call, you know, and I'm guessing, but for 2 million years, that's a long time for other bipeds to kind of coexist together.
Oh yeah, in a mouthful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think that they're a flesh and blood if they exist. I'm probably a little more skeptical on the subject than you are, but and I don't know, you know, who knows? They could cloak. They could be fairies in a bottle. But you know, I'm all about just getting to the root of it. To me, it seems like a lot of this cloaking is kind of a cop-out. It's like, I can't produce any evidence. So look at my picture. There's 4 cloaking. There's 3 gnomes, and there's a couple of fairies hovering. You know?
Right.
And that's where I think the online aspect of Bigfooting has just gotten absurd as far as the Facebook groups and stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely gone further that way. And anybody, I have my own small business that I'm trying to grow. So I've been really busy this year. But at the same time, this year I've been more active than ever as far as Bigfooting. You know, not so much on my Bigfoot Lunch Club website, but you know, I've been up to Derek Randall's place, you know, who heads the Olympic Project. Three or four times this year. I've been out in the woods several times towards the end of the summer. Been doing my hopscotch every month, and you know, been writing emails and been hanging out with what I call the old timers. You know, that are never online, like Joe Bielart, who I would say, you know, is you know, if you consider, you know, the 4 main guys who started, you know, cryptozoology or started Bigfooting, you know, Joe Beilard is probably like the second generation, you know. Same with Larry Lund, you know. These guys have breakfast in Gresham, you know, about once a month, you know, and once in a while, and Gresham is just a town about, you know, 10 miles outside of Portland, east of Portland.
Hey. Yeah. I was going to say, Guy, why do you think that is with the second generation? Some of these guys, like Joe and,
Larry Lund.
Yeah. Some of these guys have leaned towards, after many years of research, have kind of fell into that area where they kind of fall into the category of like the cloaking or mind speaking or that sort of thing. Not all of them, but
right.
A good majority have kind of joined that community or thought, you know, or have had experiences with that nature, you know, that they say they have had. Is that because they've been doing this for so long, you think, that and they can't prove it, that maybe that's all they got left with, or you think they're just coming to that realization?
One of the things, and I'm on record of saying this, is as I feel like, and I've been pretty active in the community for the past, you know, 7 or 8 years, and I've seen this kind of evolution happen, especially among the people who were so disciplined about, you know, biological about this thing. In not so nice of terms, in some ways, and this is how I feel only. I'm not speaking for anybody else.
Right.
I feel like in some ways it's kind of like giving up, right? Like, you know, if you go out fishing, you know, all day long, and you don't catch anything, you know, you think of a thousand reasons of, you know, the weather wasn't right, the season wasn't right, you know, your bait was wrong, you know. And so I think, you know, that's, there's nothing wrong with that, but I do think it's human nature to, like, you know, well, if I didn't catch a fish, then there's got to be a reason outside of my influence why I wasn't able to do that, you know. And so I do notice that, like, you know, the difference between these guys and other paranormal people, I would think, is most of these guys are leaning more towards the alien type of thing, you know. And I know, like, there's a couple people who don't mind, you know, going that angle. Like Tom Powell, he's not quite old enough to be what I would consider, you know, second generation, but he hangs out with these second generation people. He's kind of gone to that alien thing. Ron Moorhead, also a guy who's been in it for decades.
Yeah.
He's leaning towards the alien thing too.
Nephilim.
I think Ron Moorhead's kind of going there. Tom Powell's not. Tom Powell is still a really, he does, you know, he has a healthy respect for science.
So
his whole thing is he has a different angle that, and he really believes this, that science just hasn't caught up yet, but everything that he thinks is possible, or his different theories, he believes are scientific eventually, you know. I'm not sure Tom Powell, you know, would go under that, you know, what I would call it, you know, the Nephilim, but also the kind of the biblical approach to it.
Yeah,
you know?
Giants of old.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I like about, you know, a Dan Brown novel is he makes these associations, and they all fit together in a nice puzzle when you make them, you know, when you kind of cherry pick, you know, different pieces. And I do love this kind of new, lore, or this new myth about Bigfooting, you know, that's kind of trying to piece everything together. But I suppose there's something to be learned
from everything.
Yeah, but in the end, I think, you know, it's still, you know, in my mind, still kind of a Dan Brown novel. It's still, you know, a lot of associations that are interesting, entertaining, but I don't know, but I also have personal feelings about, you know, whether or not, you know, those stories in the Bible, you know, what they mean, you know, as far as, you know, because you're also taking that kind of like, you know, that Ancient Aliens, that History Channel show approach to it, that everything in there is, you know, they must have been talking about aliens. It must have been ancient aliens, you know. And you know, when you look at everything through a single perspective, everything's going to seem like that's what it's associated to.
Well, I guess what it comes down to is the fact is we don't have a Bigfoot in our possession. We do not have a body in our possession,
yeah.
And Bigfoot
so
has Bigfoot not
Bigfoot can
been
be
proved.
Anything.
Bigfoot has not been proven to exist yet. You know, many people like myself know Bigfoot exists, but I won't claim to know exactly what Bigfoot is. I just don't know. I like to think I know, but I don't.
Right.
So you got so many avenues out there, you know, and a lot of people latch on to one or another or multiple, and you know, we're kind of left with, you know, that puzzle, you know, and
yeah.
And you know, the puzzle is slowly, I think, being put together, but at the same time, a lot of times it's kind of like, you know, I have a 2-year-old, and she likes to play with her puzzle. Well, unfortunately, she likes to play with a lot of puzzles all together. So she throws other pieces in there that just don't
that is
fit.
So great. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't fit. And when I go back and I'm like, well, hey, you know, this piece doesn't fit here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take this out and find the right piece, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She eventually realizes, "Oh, okay, this doesn't belong here." And that's kind of where I'm at and where I like people to be at is, you know, you got to do it. For me, it's got to be scientific. It can't be just some random piece thrown in there going, okay, well, let's try and make this fit. Well, if it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit, you know?
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think that, you know, I believe in my heart of hearts that, you know, and I've talked to other, you know, scientific people that are academics that would be willing to, you know, take their expertise, you know, like microbiologists. Jeff Meldrum is probably the most well-known academic that is in our, you know, community. But I think that we need other ones that are more from zoology and biology, you know. And nothing to slight Meldrum. I mean, and this is also kind of a side thing, but I don't know why, like, the tree people don't love him, because he takes an anthropology approach to it, which basically is a human approach to Bigfooting in a sense, right? So he doesn't really take but he's more into the physical characteristics of the foot and stuff like that. But I would love to see, you know, other biologists or other zoologists get involved that do all sorts of things, like that basically, you know, crunch data more than anything, you know. There's a study that went out kind of comparing Bigfoot sightings, and they did ecological niche modeling, you know, which is basically, you know, which they do for all sorts of animals. And even though it was kind of like it was a little bit tongue in cheek, but it was a published paper that compared the ecological niche modeling to black bears, basically. But the whole idea is you should be able to take an animal and define its habitat to a certain degree, and then all of a sudden it would give you other areas for you to look for that same animal, right? And so they do this all the time, and they're completely successful with it, right? Where if they're looking for black bears and they're you know, trying to find out, well, there should be some black bears in this area because this meets all the criteria, and they basically plug it into a computer, you know, and then do some analysis, and they find these other areas that a black bear should be, and then they do the research, and they help them determine population to whether or not to protect these species or, determine if they're endangered or basically understand how this species interacts with all the other animals in the area. You know, so there's so much we could do if we could get other serious scientists interested in it. And so and I think that, you know, when we have people kind of dirtying the waters, you know, it makes it harder because people don't want to be a part of a community that's silly necessarily, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think
exactly.
there's no doubt that I think any community can be silly, but I think that and it's not entirely our own fault, but obviously the news is more interested in what certain people who say they've frozen Bigfoot, people who have said they shot Bigfoot, people who say that they have Bigfoot DNA. You know, these people are the ones that are being showcased on the news. You know, when Melba Ketchum came out again recently, you know, that's when all my non-Bigfooter friends send me an email and go, "What's this about?" And I go, "Well, this is stuff that's been recycled for the last 3 years. You know, it's not that new, you know." And but it gets repackaged and resent out there. Then all, you know, either people have short attention spans or the news does or whatever. But I think that one of the things that I would love to do is get other animal scientists interested in Bigfooting and at least, you know, do the due diligence or, you know, set up what it would take, you know. Shane, you and I have talked about how, you know, money well spent would be kind of to pay someone to do a Jane Goodall approach to this, you know.
Well, yeah, that's what I wanted to lead into, like, our next kind of conversation was, you know, we had talked earlier about we had talked about, you know, what your thoughts on, you know, where a lot of the research is going and what's wrong with it and where the money in general in some of these avenues are being spent, you know. So, yeah, that great point.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm in, you know, obviously, Jeff Meldrum, and I've contributed some money towards the Falcon Project, and I think that, you know, that $400,000 is a lot of money for that. And then you've heard about Melba Ketchum. You know, she was financed by somebody who's well known in the community for financing several people. And to me, you know, if you took a brave graduate student that is willing to, you know, approach Bigfooting and spend a whole year out in the woods, you wouldn't even have to spend as much money as that has been spent on Melba's project, or if that's, that might be spent on the Falcon project. You know, I'm sure there's going to be lots of benefits to having a $400,000 blimp in the air, but I think that sometimes, you know, the more simple ways, the non-technical ways, are probably our best hope. You know, I think we're reaching too far. You know, I would love to see us, you know, first do kind of a data analysis, or whether it's in the form of a niche modeling, as far as, you know, figuring out what kind of areas. I mean, we already know that, you know, the areas that have the most rain are where, you know, Bigfoot likes to hang out. You know, I mean, you put a map of sightings right on top of a precipitation map, and that's already, you know, you're kind of like poor man's ecological niche modeling, right? So then you just hit those areas, you know, with some kind of a graduate student that's willing to spend, you know, more than a weekend or a week out in the woods, you know. I think that's one of the reasons why Ron Moorhead had so much, you know, luck where he was at, because, you know, he was in an area where they packed in for weeks at a time. So I think the Bigfoot got acclimated to them, you know, and, Scott Nelson still says that audio is great audio, and there's something in there, you know. But that was only a few weeks. I think, you know, Jane Goodall spent months before she got to that point, you know. And why don't we just duplicate that and spend so much less money, you know.
Yeah, your odds go up the longer you're out there, you know. Someone send me and Shane and about 20 other people out there for a month.
Yeah.
We'll see what we can come up with.
I think, in all hot spots. Yeah, because I think, also, what people, do classically is as they go to the spot after Bigfoot has been there, and so you're chasing them, but you're not, the whole idea, I think, is to get ahead of Bigfoot and make predictions and then, kind of get ahead of him, or her.
Right.
But otherwise we're going to continue to chase Bigfoot. And I think, literally, Bigfoot is faster than us,
Yeah. And like you've said before, Shane, we need bigger teams. We need bigger operations. And, it's your odds of seeing one are like winning the lottery. And it seems like a lot of people see one just by happenstance. Some people can search for these things their whole lives and never see one.
Right.
But,
right.
But if you're applying the kind of techniques and patterns you're talking about, with large teams who are coordinated together and have the time, I think that is the key, because technology should catch up to these things, and I think that's how we're going to end up capturing one on video or film again, something that's comparable to the Patterson film. I mean, it's been almost 50 years, and people are hungry, and I think that's another reason they reach for everything they can online, and it's just become a mess is because there's nothing decent to feed this belief.
Right.
Or
right. And I think, it's one of the things I love, and it's about Bigfooting is Bigfoot is kind of like a Rorschach test. It's like an inkblot test, right? Everybody kind of projects what they see or what they think of Bigfoot, So in a lot of ways you get to learn a lot about people just by, what they think about Bigfoot, what their approach to Bigfoot
that
is.
That's so true.
I think it shows a lot about who they are as well, it's always fascinating to me, learning about, everybody's approach to Bigfoot, since there's not a ton of for sure information out there, people can't help but project, and I think that's healthy. I think, we need as many different ideas as possible, but then after that, we need a way to be able to exchange these ideas and not feel threatened and also be willing to let go of them. I know, the biggest sacred cow is the Patterson Gimlin film, right? And I think that if anybody is critical of that, you could be, shut down in the Bigfoot world, and especially if anybody who knows, Bob Gimlin well, which I've met him several times, he's, the nicest guy in the world. You talk to him and you have no doubt that Bob Gimlin saw what he saw, but at the same time, nothing should be off the table to be critical of, or nothing should be off the table that we can include, I think. I think when people get emotional about it, which has been happening, this is old news. When all three of us right on this show are talking about this, this has been happening since, back in the days of DeHinden, and Green, John Green, the original four horsemen didn't agree with each other either, but they weren't. Sometimes I wish, in some ways, if they would have cooperated, we would learn to cooperate too,
Mm-hmm. That's the thing. I watched that old In Search Of recently, when was that film? The 70s. And, I felt like I was watching something that was released today. I mean, it's like things really haven't changed much. And
right.
It's pretty wild that you'd think with all this technology and all these cameras in the woods and this interconnectedness we have online that we'd be gaining traction on this creature, but somehow it mysteriously still managed to elude us.
Right. Well, I think the bottom line is the community as a whole needs to reach out to academia. That would be that. If I was to be bold and tell and give the entire community advice. I would say we need to reach out to academia. We need their help because they have so many processes in place on how to understand a species or find a species or even, you know, find species that are specifically rare, you know. And I think they would help out, and that would be, you know, the first thing that we could do, you know, is have someone from academia help us organize a way or a protocol to do this, you know. And I think that, you know, we haven't done that yet, you know. So, and also I think the other thing is we should try things that we haven't tried before. You know, one of the things that that I'm kind of proud of right now is we're doing some hypnosis regression on some witnesses, and we're getting some crazy stuff. And when we package it all together, I'll release more information. But we've been able to do some hypno regression on some high profile people, and we're hoping to get, you know, a really big name pretty soon. And I think even that, you know, where we can bring someone back to the moment where they had an encounter, we might be able to find something or help them remember something that will help us understand Bigfoot behavior.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all sounds great. It's a step in the right direction because obviously what we're doing now isn't working. And I like that blimp idea. I think that's pretty cool. Something innovative and different, and hopefully that can get off the ground and, you know, be pretty neat, yield some results. But the more I learn about this creature, honestly, the less I believe.
Yeah.
You'd think it would be the other way around, but I've grew up in the outdoors and I've studied maps and topography and all sorts of things, and there's something that just doesn't add up about it all. I mean, even recently Buddy was telling me about they use helicopters for missing people and with therms, and the police will go cover huge areas, you know, looking for a human-like heat source, you know, and stuff like that, and, you know, they're not finding Bigfoot or... So, I mean, is Bigfoot hiding from helicopters and planes? And, yeah, these national forests and state forests, they're remote and whatnot, but if you blow up a map, you'll find ATV trails, hunting, campgrounds. You know,
well,
there's,
Johnny,
still a lot of activity going on.
Let me add on that, and the fact that you just mentioned that. One of the areas that I research in, there's a missing man. He's missing since 2010 in an area that I travel to, and a lot of hikers do too. This guy's been missing for a number of years. They found his tent in his car. He left, some hikers saw him leaving with his fishing gear, his backpack, his clothes. I mean, the guy was fully dressed to go hiking out to one of the local lakes that are hard to, I mean, they're a hike in, they're hard to get to, and they've had National Guard out there and everything. They never found a trace of this guy. His fishing pole, his backpack, his clothes, his body have never been found. So, I mean... Yeah, they have all these resources that, you know, that can find things, but yet they've never found a trace of this guy. He just completely disappeared.
Yeah. Where you guys live is the most logical because you have the mountains and the huge stretches of national forests where there's not as much activity, but you get areas like Ohio, that's primarily deciduous forests, and a lot of their pine stands, I heard, are getting diseased now. I mean... Where's Bigfoot going in the winter? You know, you can see right through those woods. So it's just, there's a lot of things that just don't add up to me. You know, like you said, Guy, if I was to see one, though, with my own eyes, see the muscle movement, be in an area where I could know it wasn't a hoax, you know, then I'd be a full believer. But the more I study things, it just doesn't add up.
Right, and that's one of the things that, you know, I'm not a big fan of Bigfoot being anywhere other than the West Coast myself, you know.
Right.
You know, I know that, and especially, you know, Southern Oregon, Northern Washington, I would also include, you know, the Olympic Rainforest in Washington too. I mean, you know, I spent more time this year up there than I ever had before. And when you go up there, I mean, that is, if I was a Sasquatch, of all the three different kind of distinct areas I've been in, I'd be up in Washington right now. That's where I would, you know, would hang out if I was in Bigfoot, you know. But I do have, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the TV show tries to, you know, their approach is that, you know, Bigfoot is everywhere. Every town, every state has a Bigfoot in it, you know, and I don't necessarily agree. And, you know, one of the things that I did like hearing from, was that, you know, the skunk ape and all that stuff is probably not even a Bigfoot. And Dr. Jeff Meldrum said that he thinks there's only one species of Bigfoot. So when you hear about all these, like, different versions of Bigfoot, you know, those, you know, are you know, basically, you know, according to, you know, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, is those are something else completely, in misidentification or whatever. He thinks that in the Northwest, there either is a single type of species of Bigfoot or there isn't, but these, you know, three-toed things and all these other, you know, six-fingered things are not Bigfoot, you know, and I don't know if they are real or if they exist, but I'm the same thing. I think if Bigfoot exists, I'm probably just hanging out here in the West Coast.
Yeah, that's all I knew about. Growing up, it was a faraway thing, Pacific Northwest or the Abominable Snowman. It wasn't until finding Bigfoot and all these different TV shows. You know, I remember seeing a TV show on Bigfoot in Texas years ago, and my buddy just started laughing. He's just like, Bigfoot in Texas? But then we watched the show, and they did the correlation of rainfall to the Bigfoot sightings, and it somewhat matched, and that kind of sucked me back into it all. You know, I was into Bigfoot and Loch Ness growing up, but it was these TV shows that really turned the obsession knob back on. But now I study more, and I look at population charts, and I see, well, that's where the majority of the people are as well. You know, and so more people, more chances of someone having a sighting. So, yeah, the Bigfoot sightings match the rainfall. They also match the bear somewhat and population centers. Yeah, Ohio is fourth in sightings, but it's also, like, fifth most populated state. So the only thing that defies that logic of population is states like Oregon and things where they have the high sightings, but they're not one of the most populated states people-wise.
I was going to say, a Blog Talk kicked me off earlier, and I don't know if you guys heard my question or thoughts, but I mean, I agree with Guy on the Falcon Project. I mean, I'm a big enthusiast on that and a fan. At the same time, if somebody wanted to pay me to go out there for months on end, I would. You know, I can't afford to do that myself. I can afford, you know, out of the year, weekends and weeks, but I can't afford to spend what is needed to be out there in the woods. You know, I mean, really, you need that Jane Goodall approach where you're living out there and not just, you know, you're traveling around, you're looking for evidence and, you know, making yourself known to be out there. And I can't afford that.
Right.
And like I said, I'm not bashing on the Falcon Project. Guy, you kind of opened my eyes a little bit and made me think a little bit more about it, but that type of money could be more well spent in some aspects, putting somebody on the ground for months on end, like a Derek Randall's or what have you, to, you know, live out there, and all they're doing is looking for evidence and studying and doing a scientific approach. I'm not.
You mean us, Shane?
Yes. Yes. Sorry. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Somebody please pay us. I honestly wish I could do this full time. It's my passion and. You know, I wish
all.
Yeah, but
well, I'm
in
still young enough and spry enough to, you know, be like a gazelle in those woods.
Well, I mean, I'm more like a, you know, a sniper. But anyways, I mean, you know, that's what I'm saying is, you know, I'm a big proponent of it, but Guy kind of made me, got my wheels turning, made me think about this a little bit more, and he had a huge point when I was on the phone with him that, you know, we really do need that Jane Goodall approach where you're out there, because really, what are you going to prove from the Fulcrum Project? I mean, maybe, I'm not discounting it, but there's a bigger, you can collect more evidence on the ground than you can, in my opinion, from the air.
Yeah, you're right.
The more,
they might
the more I think about
a sketchy
yeah.
therm that could be just a camper or a person, and yeah, I mean, I guess all if it's nighttime, you're going to have a lot of inconclusive stuff. I mean, yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, and plus, no matter where your philosophy is on the spectrum of how human Bigfoot is or how much of an animal Bigfoot is or primate Bigfoot is, you know, one thing that I think anybody could agree on is that if you're out there, the best way to get them acclimated to you is for you to spend some time out there and for them to get to know you, right? And I think that if you go out there, Bigfoot, whatever, however intelligent or however close to humans are, or close to primates, you know, they are. I think that that you need to spend enough time out there so they're willing to come in closer. You know, because like you were saying, is most of the people who have sightings, it's by accident. You know, Bigfoot's
yeah.
crossing the road. Bigfoot's you know they were
yes.
they were taking a leak and boom, it was there. You know, all those things. You know, so none of those things have happened on purpose. Or rarely have they happened on purpose, and I think so. Those were accidents, and we need to make it not an accident. You know,
mm-hmm.
you can't.
So true.
you can't. You can't rely on buying a lottery ticket every week and hoping that that's what's going to help you retire. You know, you also have to have the plan to work hard, save money, and invest. You know, as well. And I think it's the same. I think that's true for the outcome of Bigfooting is basically most of us are, you know, buying a lottery ticket, hoping that's the winning ticket. But there's also, you know, but most people who retire in this world in a comfortable, you know, setting had planned for it, had paid for it, had, you know, and then, you know, and didn't rely on a lottery ticket to get there, you know?
Right. And Guy, I mean, I fully believe I will not be the one personally prove the fact that Bigfoot exists. And I'm sure many researchers out there would like to say that they'll be the one to prove it. I don't think me, by my own personal efforts, will be the one to prove it. It's going to take a joint effort, you know, and I've been trying to do this for a number of years now. Because, you know, I do have an area, and a lot of researchers do, that we think that are hot spots or great areas, but I think it's going to be a joint effort with more than myself and bigger people than myself as far as academia is concerned to prove it, you know, and a lot of people, you know, and I agree with not sharing areas that are, you know, hot spots, but, you know, we got to branch out a little bit and try to include a little bit bigger of the academia and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I would love for, you know, for an academic, you know, to at least, you know, put in the time to say, well, this is what you should be doing. You should have, like, you know, and I'm just, you know, making this up,
yeah.
but, you know, they would say things like, you know, you would have to have a grid and you would have to, you know, hang out in this grid, you know, and for this X amount of time every day, you know, and blah, 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 or, and then, you know, report to this person. And then these are the things that you need to record, you know, this is the type of equipment that you should have. And then this is the type of database you need so we can actually go through this. You know, I think that's the other half of it too, is I think that that, you know, one of the technologies that we do have that we don't even touch is statisticians. You know, I don't know if anybody's ever seen Moneyball, but that's the whole idea that the that the Athletics were they didn't have as much money as the other teams to purchase players, right? So all the other teams could afford to buy the best players. So what they did, the character that Brad Pitt plays, hires this guy to basically go to the statistics of all the other players, and they build a perfect team based on the statistics of how well these guys play, not based on how much they cost. And that year, the Athletics, you know, did phenomenal. You know, they didn't win the series, but they did better than other people who outspend them 10 to 100 times more, that had hundreds of millions of dollars more than they had, you know. But that's all based on you know, these baseball nerds that basically go through these statistics, and they could build the perfect team. You know, same with, you know, those, you know, the people who win at poker, or the people who have the best football fantasy teams, are statisticians, you know. And I think that's the other thing that we could really, you know, get help from is someone take all this data, because we do have monstrous data, even if we just took, you know, the data from the BFRO. But, you know, John Green has a database of sightings and tons of information. Yeah. If we could have, you know, someone who probably one of the most famous statisticians is a guy named Nate Silver. He correctly predicted the outcome of the last election, including the senators and the congressmen and all that stuff. You know, I think he was only wrong by one guy. But for some guy to basically crunch all the numbers and make predictions for how the elections would come out is a pretty amazing feat. And I think that, you know, we could also make some pretty good predictions as well if we had the right, you know, people working on it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that we just, you know, somehow we need to get, you know, create a foundation that that encourages, you know, people to get academics to help us. And you know, if we could raise money for that foundation, you know, that would be so awesome to you know, get other people that could help us in a more formal way, in a way that we could document this stuff too, you know, because that's one of the things that I miss about the old school Bigfooters is they did such a better job of documenting their expeditions.
Yeah, and not every shadow was a Bigfoot.
Yeah, I mean, you take John Green's database. I mean, which is a publicly available to everybody online, and I mean, you could basically, you know, narrow down your search to, you know, all the sightings that are, you know, 50 meters close to water, and then you start seeing all these sorts of parallels when you just, you know, read all these sightings that are from, you know, all different places, but then you start to see, well, there's got to be some kind of a you know, running water connection. And what is it? Is it a lake or is it running water? Well, it's not a lake. It's actually running water all these times that people have these sightings, you know. So, you know, that's, you know.
No, that's a great point, you know. That's something I always preach to people when either they ask me, you know, where should I look or where should I hang out or where should I go if I want to, you know, do this sort of thing. Water, obviously, is the key thing.
Yeah.
You know, for any wild animal, you know, and Bigfoot is not excluded from this.
Yeah.
Regard, you know, forget about what your, you know, your beliefs in Bigfoot. It needs water, in my opinion. Period.
Yeah.
You know, and
except
you
for
know,
when they cloak.
I mean, except, well, yeah, maybe they need it when they cloak. I don't know, but water is a necessity and. The areas that I go to have water, and they usually produce, you know, in my opinion, results. You know, what those results are subject to whoever, but water is the key, you know, I mean, really, for anything. And, you know, that's
so
where I go. That's where I go to. That's where I look to, you know, is I find a water source, a fresh water source, whether it's a lake or a stream
river.
Or a river, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and absolutely. And that's key, you know, and a lot of people look towards areas that have nothing in sight as far as water, you know.
Right,
and
right.
That's a big foul.
I've also heard people. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You've heard people.
Like, you know, I don't know if it was a Texas wood ape agency or what, but they have some data about different soil types or salinity of soil or something like that in correlation to Bigfoot even. And I've also heard,
wow,
like, if it was granite-y areas where there's granite in the soil, there's Bigfoots, and there's all sorts of stuff like that that is pretty interesting. I'm going to have to try and dig that up again, but I thought that was I think it's through a group of Texas had a big chart about, you know, there's certain potassium levels in the soil or whatever that have to be a certain level for Bigfoot.
It is interesting,
like,
you know.
Yeah.
I think we got a caller there, Johnny.
Okay. 330, you're on the Monster X Radio.
Hey, Paul Hayes, Janoska Project. What's up, fellas?
Hey, Paul.
Hey,
how you doing?
Paul.
I'm trying to get caught up here. It had to take me a little break, but no, I was kind of listening to the guy talking about, you know, databases and stuff like that. Man, I'd love to have one, you know, but my God, they take just so much time, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't have that much time.
Right. You know, and that's the biggest problem too. You know, is that, you know, I think we all wish we had, you know, more time to work on this. You know, I mean, if I could set aside everything for a while and just focus on this, I think I could do a much better job at doing Bigfoot research and you know, and everybody else too. You know, I mean, that's the toughest thing is you know, we almost need to have a foundation that can raise money and make sure that money is spent well on people who do this for a living. You know, Franzoni he's not too public, but he was one of the first guys that kind of worked with Matt Moneymaker on the BFRO, and he kind of helped with the design of the original database that they created. And but this, you know, the BFRO database is, you know, 20 years old now, you know, and same with John Green's database that is online is out of date too. Nowadays, you know, databases allow you to basically, you know, visualize a lot of that data. And, you know, that's how most of these people who are studying these things get the most out of these databases. They can visualize this stuff. You know, they could put in a pie chart quickly, you know, what the best sightings are, what time of day is to go out there and what time these sightings happen. And even nowadays you could find out, you know, how many people were in the party that saw the Bigfoot, you know? So even if we have a database, which we have two decent databases out there, the ability to data mine them, to mine that data, is not that great, you know? So we really need an interface to that too. So, I agree with you. It'd be nice to have a database, and they do take lots of time. But at some point, if we're going to move further, we either need to raise enough money to hire someone that does have time to do this, you know, kind of end up with the same results that we've had for the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I can agree with that. You know, there for a little while, I started on one, and it just, my God, it just took so much time and time and time, and I didn't have time to do anything else, and, you know, so I kind of just scrapped the project because, you know, trying to put all that information and, you know, just get it, you know, even gathering all the information. And
absolutely, yeah.
You know, takes an abundance amount of time. And you know, one thing also would help us, you know, if all the non-reported sites would be reported, you know, that would help us out some too, you know. You know, just for example, and knowing, we had a town meeting here a few weeks ago or whatever, and you know, and we asked the people, you know, if there was anybody that had seen or heard or, you know, anything they couldn't explain or whatever, and nobody would say anything. And then there was a gentleman sitting in the clear front row, and his wife was beside him, and she brought it up and put him on the spot because he said she was the only one that he's ever told. And this happened back in the early 50s when he had his encounter. And, you know, she brought it up, put him on the spot. So then he kind of, he didn't get into great detail, but, you know, you could tell he was really credible on that. But it's like him, you know, his isn't reported, you know, and you know, from what he said, you know, it was like, I think he said it was in the early 50s, and it was about 11 o'clock at night, and him and his buddy was out in the woods, and, you know, and he goes, there was no light, no nothing, no moon, and he goes, he thought his buddy was standing right in front of him, and he reached out, and I think his buddy's name was Jack, and he reached out, you know, hey, is that you, Jack? Well, here was one of these creatures standing right there in front of him, and it smacked his arm away. So,
oh, jeez.
Yeah, and you could tell the way he told it. If you'd have seen his face, he relived that moment. You could tell. Yeah,
no,
so you know,
yeah.
If you can get all them really good, you know, sightings like that, you know, all recorded and everything, and you know, it's like, you know, whenever I interview somebody, you know, I like to get as much detail as I can as possible, you know.
Actually,
you know, what time of the year,
you
know, what day, was it afternoon, morning, you know, was it raining, you know, all that kind of stuff. And
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they remember, you know, a lot of that stuff, and then sometimes they don't, you know, so.
Well, I think it's true, you know, even when you wake up from a dream, it's amazing how fast that dream can disappear, you know, and then you start to forget those details, you know, just within a few minutes, let alone, you know, that's why, you know, and I agree with you, there's so many encounters that have already probably, you know, gone, you know, people have buried with them, you know, where, you know, one of the first witnesses that we did the hypno-regression on was a guy who had never talked about Bigfoot to anybody. And he had two great encounters, one when he was 10 and one when he was 16. And he actually got to see the Bigfoot right in the face and change facial expressions and stuff like that. And it was just luck that I was able to meet him, and we were able to kind of record and catalog his encounter. But I think you're absolutely right. There are so many stories out there. There's so many encounters out there that we may never get because we don't have the ability to capture them, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and Guy, I mean, the way you came upon that whole regression, I mean, how that whole event took place as far as you meeting him and everything, that's fantastic. He was part of the Hopsquatch, and that was fantastic.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and, you know, the hypnotist that I work with, you know, Doug Meacham, and I would encourage if anybody, you know, lives in the Portland area and they want to have some kind of regression and go back to their encounter, you know, definitely get a hold of me, and then we will do some kind of hypno regression. We've done some high profile people already that you wouldn't necessarily think that would be interested, but after Doug Meacham did his presentation, I think people realize what hypnosis really is and what it's capable of doing. And we've had some witnesses that I would thought I'd never see, you know, cry, you know, get so emotional when they see, you know, Bigfoot again, you know, in their regression. You know, it's a creepy thing. And again, this is, you know, based on the scientificness of the hairs on the back of my neck. But man, when these people go from present tense or from past tense to present tense, like they start off like, oh, I was walking in the woods, and all of a sudden, now I hear this, and I see this, and all of a sudden they talk as if they're right there in that moment, and they get there. That happens every time, and that when that transition happens, and they're actually like reliving that moment, that's just. Like there's, it's better than any movie, and it's better than reading a report. You feel like you're there, you know.
Wow.
And so, fortunately, we've videotaped all these things. So eventually, you know, those that are happy to release it, you know, we'll share those, you know, sometime down the line. But we're just trying to gather information right now, and then we'll repackage it as a presentation for sure.
Hey, Paul, you know. You heard some of Guy's comments earlier, and you're out of Ohio. I mean, what are your thoughts on, you know, Bigfoot existing out there? I mean, you've been on our show before. You know, what are the possibilities of a...
Well, where'd he go?
I think we lost him, huh?
Yeah, lost him.
I think, well, I guess I'll have to call back
still,
in here.
He was probably going to ask me what are my possibilities about Bigfoot in Ohio, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, they're definitely here. I've actually had, you know, I live in the eastern side of Ohio here, and I had my first encounter September 2011. And then here, June of 2013, actually had another one. My first one was a daytime sighting about 6:30 p.m., and my second one was a nighttime, and it was about 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. And during my first sighting, I had my oldest son with me. He was about 23 at the time. And then the nighttime sighting, there was, oh, geez, there was me. I had my team members with me. So there was, see, there was one, two, three, four, five. There were six people that witnessed the nighttime one. Now, the first one in September 2011 in the daytime, it was only about 100 foot from us. So, you know, there was definitely no mistake in that. And then the nighttime one, it was probably about 120, 130 feet from our base camp. They're definitely here. What's weird about my sighting is, you know, I'm probably figuring that it was just coming through the area, because I've had absolutely nothing since the first week of, well, I might as well say at the end of the year 2013 till present, I've had nothing. But on my first sighting, I was actually out on my back porch at 2 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, directly to my left, single row of large pine trees, that divides my yard from the cornfield, because I'm the last house on the road there. And just on the other side of them cornfield, I heard, or them trees, I heard that low guttural growl, and I'm kind of looking over, but I'm not seeing anything, you know. And so I just continued to stand there, and maybe 30 seconds or so later, it did it again. And then I ended up going back in the house. And then the next night, I was out there at 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was like the same thing all over again. So I go back in the house, and just then the wife, she gets up, and she's going to go out, because we go out and smoke, because we don't smoke in the house. And I told her, I said, if you're going to go out there, there's something out there been growling at me, you know, tonight and last night. And then she tells me she knows, because she's heard it before, but she's never said anything. And then during that whole week, you know, I would just kind of wander through the tree line and stuff, and I would just find, you know, all these different stick structures, just, you know, things that just didn't look natural. And then my son came over at the end of the week, and I was showing him some of that stuff, and we actually took a walk back in the woods where we actually crossed over two creeks back there. And then once we got over that second creek, we split off. I went south, he went north, and then I heard him holler for me, and I get over there, and he goes, hey, do you smell that? And I'm like, yeah, but what the heck is it, you know? And he says, man, I don't know. I mean, it was putrid. It was really bad. And so we searched that whole little area that he was in, and we came up with nothing. So then we were on our way back home, and we were probably about 20 feet from crossing over the last creek so we could, you know, go across the field and everything to get home. And he's walking in front of me, about 6 foot in front of me, and he just stops, you know. So I asked him what he was doing. And he told me to look, and he's pointing to his left. And I looks over, but I couldn't see what he was looking at. And so I asked him again. He's going, man, right there. And I kind of hunched down to look underneath this branch, and there that thing stood about 100 feet from us. It was on, there's two creeks, and it crossed over the one creek and was standing. It was pretty much out in the open. He wasn't hiding in no brush, or he wasn't hiding behind a tree. He was standing in front of a large tree that was right beside that creek, and he's rocking his upper body back and forth, kind of looking in our direction. And, you know, I knew he knew that we were there, but I don't think he knew our exact location, and I think he was trying to find us. And, you know, but during that whole sighting right there, I couldn't tell you how long it was. It could have been 15 seconds, 30 seconds. It could have been a minute. Could have been 10 seconds. You know, I don't know. It's like you're just amazed at the massive size of this thing. And, yeah, it's something I'll never forget.
What time of year was it?
That was September of 2011. It was actually
wow.
September 9th of 2011. You know, there were still some, leaves on the trees and stuff like that. You know, there was no snow or nothing, but, yeah, so they're here, that's for sure. And then the sighting that we had when we were doing an expedition on some private property, it's probably like 30 minutes south of where I had my sighting. So,
well, I think you guys got a pretty good area.
Hey,
yeah.
Guys, I want to ask Guy a question here. I mean, what are your thoughts, you know, if Bigfoot exists on, you know, them traveling around, you know, and do they hibernate? Do they travel? What are your thoughts on that, if they exist?
Yeah, well, I definitely think there is some migration. I've plugged in, you know, some of the information from the different databases, you know, on my personal computer, and if you take basically a timeline and you start from 1950, you know, you can visualize where the sightings are, based on time, based on seasons. You definitely see that they migrate in elevations, you know, so as far as, you know, just within the same year, you know. And there's also more of a generic push for them that are moving, you know, north, so which also seems to be true for most of the bigger animals, based on, the climate change, you know. So.
Yeah.
Not only do you see them move, based on, you know, and this is just based on what has been reported on the two databases from, you know, I've scraped the BFRO one, and I scraped John Green's database, you know, put them together, and I think there's about four or five other smaller databases that are publicly out there. You combine them all, and there's definitely, from what is reported, is that annual migration in elevation, but also you see them all moving north, you know. And so I think as climate change actually does happen, you know, regardless of if you think it's a man-made or not, the truth is that temperatures are rising. As they rise, these sightings, you're actually getting more sightings in the north. It used to be Northern California was the best place, you know. Then it kind of, you know, for the last couple of decades, it was really, you know, south of Mount Hood in Oregon, and you're seeing that the, you know, northern Washington is getting more traction now. So I think there's migration. I'm not so sure if they hibernate. You know, I think they just when it gets colder, they actually go to lower elevations and live out there in the lower parts, and I don't think they have a problem living too close to people. You know, I don't think it's crazy that they might even, you know, utilize, you know, you know, people's trash and stuff like that. You know, I
there's
no doubt in my mind
believe.
There's no doubt in my mind that Sasquatches are intelligent, you know, and are probably definitely opportunists, you know.
I have a hard time swallowing that pill because we would have discovered them. You know, we have cameras on buildings with dumpsters, and you know, that's why I think we're dealing with a higher intelligent human thing that knows to avoid us. I wrote an article a while ago on my blog about why does Bigfoot avoid us, and you know, I made one reference, they could fear our disease, they could fear, you know, many things, sickness. I mean, if they saw what we did to the Native Americans as far as bringing disease, they might not want anything to do with us. I haven't seen any proof of habituation. You know, there's a lot of fanciful stories out there, but I just, these things aren't 2 feet tall, you know. Where's the impact on the environment, you know? It's amazing. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a guy that I think he bought like 30 or 40 or some crazy amount of game cams, and recorded the high frequency noise that came out of them, right? And so, you know, even from that angle, where, you know, he basically had them in his garage and he had them lined up against all four walls or three walls, and turned them on and recorded, and said every single one of those lights emits a high frequency noise that we can't hear, you know. So even from that angle, if they have sensitive enough ears, they could avoid those cameras just because they don't like, you know, that sound could be, you know, maddening to them, you know. But they all emitted a sound that is not too far outside of our ability to hear, you know. They weren't like ultrasonic or whatever. They were just a very high pitch that we wouldn't pick up on, that, you know. But, you know, and I like to play devil's advocate both ways, you know. I mean, over the last, you know, 50 years or so, you know, there's probably been 100, you know, airplanes that have crashed more than that, but there's about 100 of them that have never been found, you know, in the Northwest alone. And so these are objects that we knew the trajectory. They're way bigger than Bigfoot. And the people who are flying them, these are private planes, so they definitely had finances. It's like, so you had all those three things going for them, where they probably had the money, they probably had the will, they had a general idea of the direction the plane was going, and it's big, you know, it's a big object, and yet these planes they have not been able to find. So I think it's not as easy to find something in the woods as I think a lot of people might think, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, no, you're so true. I mean, that's a great point. You know,
but if it's digging in your garbage every night, you're gonna find it. You know, I guess I'm just tired of all this. Bigfoot is everywhere. Bigfoot's eating my jelly donuts in my backyard. You know, to me, it's become like fantasy for grown-ups.
I gotta agree with that.
Anything's possible, but
just need to put better stuff in your trash, man.
I guess I'm ready for some proof of anything.
You know what I don't get is, I mean, you got, I mean, you know, I'm not really knocking the people to go out and do this, because they are getting out there and, you know, trying to do, you know, whatever to get some type of evidence. But got all these people that go, okay, I set out a plate of bananas and I set out a plate of apples and I set out a plate of this. And I went back the next morning and only the bananas were gone, but the rest of it was, you know, still there. Well, how do you know it wasn't a freaking raccoon? You know
right.
what I mean? How do
right.
you know it wasn't?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and they don't ever set up any type of, you know, equipment
right.
to try and get any pictures or anything. They just say, well, this plate's empty and this one isn't, you know.
Right. Yeah. And that's pure conjecture. I mean, that's where, you know, that's fine in your own little group on Facebook or online. But, I mean, really, in the scheme of things, we need, if your goal is to be recognized or at least, you know, be, or prove the existence of Sasquatch or Bigfoot online or anywhere, you need to have some science to back it up. And those claims are, you know, a dime a dozen, you know, and they really don't mean anything, you know. Get a giggle out of it, or you believe it or you don't, you know. Simple as that.
Right. Well, here not too long ago, won't mention a name or nothing, but, you know, there's a spot that this individual or individuals go, you know, all the time, and, you know, they're constantly sitting out, you know, all these bowls with food or whatever. And I think the last time I heard them say, hey, the last time we was there, you know, we set the food out and we heard all this noise and, you know, there was like 14 of them around our camp. And I'm like, really? Yeah. And, you know, the bananas were gone and one of the sandwiches were gone and, you know, and all that. Okay, well, show me some damn pictures or something. So they would come up with a blob squatch photo. You expect me to make something out of that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I have my own blob squatch photos, but I don't share them. I keep them myself. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
No sense in sharing because I'm not going to, you know, try to explain to somebody and I'm not going to circle the area and you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I
was going to ask Guy, how much Bigfoot, you know, I mean, how much stuff do you get sent, you know, to your email or on Facebook?
I get tons of blob squatches, I mean, all the time, you know, and, you know, fortunately, you know, people don't ask, you know, me to comment on them too much, you know, and usually, you know, I say, you know, that's great. You know, but some of them I really can't see anything in them, and it takes a lot of time. But I also get sent a lot of just kind of the floating heads, you know, where people see the eyes and the nose and the mouth, and I can see that too. But there's no body underneath it, you know. And
you actually got my emails, thank God.
No, that's just from
you.
Yeah.
You never respond back.
Yeah. I have more floating heads from Shane, yeah. So. and I get a lot of, you know, people who share their sightings and stuff like that. You know, I think it's great stuff, you know. But I think that, you know, you know, photos, audio, all that stuff. You know, the best I can do is point us in a direction, but I still think that we're going to need a specimen. I think we're still going to need a body. I mean, even if we took a really good video of it, it's still going to be under scrutiny. You know,
it's that elephant in the room that nobody likes to admit. You know, it's you could have a Sasquatch walk 2 feet in front of you and film it, and people are going to still be like, oh, bull crap, CGI, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. You really, in the end, I think, you know, whether you want it or not, if you know, it's going to take a body, period.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people, I hate to see these, you know, sometimes, you know, these false debates that we've been having for a long time, you know, I don't think anybody really wants to, you know, kill a Bigfoot. And I think, you know, there's a few people that might, but for the most part, you know, I think when most people say that they would like to have a Bigfoot body, I think most people, that doesn't mean they want to kill one. That means that they want to, you know, that's going to satisfy science or anybody who wants proof. Another thing is, I think, is a false debate that, you know, is a distraction is, you know, how human or how primitive or how much of an animal Bigfoot is. I think that's
the biggest debate in the community for those that believe or have seen or whatever have you, you know, is.
Yeah.
Yeah. period. I mean, that's the biggest debate.
And I think, you know, sometimes, you know, these people who are debating are talking about the same thing, you know. I mean, sometimes you hear the argument, well, they're too smart, they're too much like us to be a primate. Well, I mean, I would consider humans a primate too, you know, that, and so so
there's some pretty dumb humans.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, when we argue that we're really talking past each other, and so I think, you know, mostly as you know, they can be a primate and be very closely related to us. They can be very smart. They can even have culture, all that stuff. You know, perhaps, you know, but if we argue, you know, to what degree, there's no way to, you know, prove one point or the other. So we can say, you know, both those are valid until we actually find out, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, we are apes too, you know. So
true, but no great ape has ever been known to live in this northern hemisphere. So that would be kind of a new thing.
Humans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're right. It's and a lot of it is just being on Facebook. And you, when you're on these social media sites, you're going to get everything. You know, it's one really just has to get out there themselves. Or like Shane, you said, a lot of the good people or a lot of the decent evidence doesn't even go on Facebook. So.
Right, exactly. You know, and Guy can probably vouch for this, that some of probably the best stuff he's seen will never be shown. You know, yeah, I mean, just period, because these guys don't jump on online or Facebook or, you know, they don't post this stuff, period, because it's great evidence or what have you, but they just don't post it because it doesn't prove anything, and all they're going to get back is backlash and hate,
mm-hmm.
you know, right,
right,
Guy? I mean, do you agree with that?
No, absolutely, you know, like a... You take those, you know, second generation people like Larry Lunds and Joe Bilart, and they have tons and tons of folders and not just folders but whole drawers and drawers of all this data that they've collected and organized. Larry Lund has a whole basement full of Bigfoot stuff, you know, that no one would ever, you know, see. He gave me a whole paper bag full of videos that he's collected over the years that he just gave, you know, Joe Bilart gave it to me. I haven't even gone through all the videos, but you watch these VHS tapes, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe, like, you know, we don't know this, or this is not something that we haven't thought about yet. So it's true. The best stuff is locked up in someone's garage and stuff like that. And it's kind of funny because there's kind of a market for this stuff, which most people don't. So there's like these rich people that are like avid Bigfooters that are actually buying this stuff from these older guys. They're buying their research just so they could keep it as a collector's item, right? And so that stuff, once that goes that way, that stuff will definitely never see. You know, that's going to be so in someone's, you know, some of this research is going in people's private collections, you know?
Yeah, you know, I mean, people hate hearing the word privy, you know, but a lot of these guys that, you know, have contact with each other, the real hardcore researchers that are never online or doing that sort of thing, they share stuff, you know, within each other, and that stuff's never shown or, you know, whether it's trail cam pictures, documentation in general. It's never shown or shared, and most people, you know, will never see that until Bigfoot's proven. You know, maybe it'll come out then, but a lot of it, I mean, there's some really good evidence out there, and I've seen a lot of it. You know, Guy, I know you have.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff that really could rock a lot of boats, but really it doesn't do anything to prove the existence. It just kind of adds a little bit of flavor to the field or, you know, possibles, but... you know, it's kind of a shame, but at the same time, why these guys aren't going to put their necks on the line for you know, two-bit has-beens to rip them apart when it doesn't prove anything, you know?
Right, right. And I would say there's a whole generation worth of research that is that most of the community doesn't have access to or hasn't seen or even, you know, maybe people who are even on the fringe of the community and would consider themselves just like, you know, general enthusiasts, you know, there's stuff that's out there that even I think these researchers don't know about. Like, you know, during this breakfast, when I was having breakfast with Joe Bielart and Larry Lund, you know, Larry Lund was actually, you know, going through his stuff, and these guys were talking in almost a different language because they knew so much shorthand for different areas and different people and different sightings and stuff like that. Like, so to listen, you knew that they were talking about something important, but you didn't catch all the references. And so these guys can speak shorthand now about a whole generations of sightings and evidence and stuff like that that we may not have access to once they pass, you know, because, I mean, to be a fly in the room when they were just talking, it was probably the highlight this year for me is to listen to these guys talk about old school Bigfooting, you know.
Well, having Joe Bielhart at your hopsquatch for me was huge because talk about a guy who's done his research, who's been in the Bigfoot world for more than most.
Yeah,
and the amount of research he's done on areas. I mean, he was talking about the Detroit area here in Oregon, Detroit Lake area, that just blew my mind. I mean, it blew my mind because he had contacted, you know, the ranger stations. He had found out the names for certain areas, and they, you know, we're talking about Indian names that were erased from time and whatnot. Some of those names were just, you know, devil's this and, you know, hairy man this. And I mean, just that your average person would never look up or, you know, even consider trying to find. I mean, that was phenomenal. And I really respect, you know, we disagree in some areas, but Joe Bielhart is really an amazing person. And like I said, you know, you had him at your hopsquatch event What an awesome opportunity to listen to what he had to say, because he's not a Facebook person or online person, you know.
Absolutely.
Have to, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I felt super fortunate that he was, you know, happy to do it, you know, and he's one of those guys that he is going to come out with some of the best things. But I was also fortunate enough to. He had a map at the hopsquatch and it showed the Cascade Highway. And so I actually drove down the Cascade Highway with him, and he kind of gave me the audio version as we were hitting all these different spots, you know.
You bastard.
And it was just like, I know. it was like the best thing in the world. It was like, you know, 3 hours later, I was like, man, I can pretty much, you know, just, you know, check out now. That was awesome, you know.
Yeah.
So, I think that, you know, I would like to get these guys more into the public so we could kind of, you know, at least have discipline. These guys were so disciplined about their approach to things, and they would go that extra mile to follow a lead. And I think that's, you know, that's something that, you know, I wish I had time or more discipline for myself. And I think there's, you know, there are researchers out there that maybe have that time, but don't have that discipline, and I wish, you know, I wish we could get that going, because, you know, they asked every question and followed every lead until they hit a dead end on each encounter, you know, so it's amazing.
Yeah. You know, I was going to say, you know, Derek Reynolds is one of those guys that has, you know, been around for a long time that, you know, he's, I consider him a really good friend of mine and been around a long time, and his research too, you know, a lot of people don't look to the past. They look what's present, and they just, you know, kind of put somebody in a nutshell. Derek Reynolds has been doing this for a long time, just like your Joe Bielharts and even your Cliff Brockmans and whatnot. I mean, Cliff's been at this for years, you know. Some of these guys have been doing this for years and years, and the amount of research and stuff they've collected kind of gets tucked underneath the rug. And to me, that's kind of a really, it's a displeasure, and kind of, I'll be honest, it kind of pisses me off, because, you know, they put their necks on the line a lot of times by doing a lot of stuff. Even Sykes, you know, Sykes has been on this new show recently, and he's taking a lot of heat for it. But at the same time, you know, they're putting their necks on the line. He's got a book coming out, I believe, and has some more evidence to the show that wasn't shared. You know, these guys get hit so hard as being forefront fathers of the Bigfoot community and proponents of it, you know. I mean, it really kind of irks me that these guys get hit so hard when yet, you know, people follow them, but yet they hit them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing is like, you know, we should, you know, be encouraging and, you know, be more, you know, I think there's nothing, for whatever reason, there's nothing wrong with disagreeing. And I think that there should be a more civil way. And Shane, you know,
yeah.
you know the type
of
group of people. Yeah. What's that?
Yeah, you're right. You know, a lot of this is just speculation. We all have our own opinions and conclusions we have drawn. But does that mean I'm right? No. Does it mean you're right? No. You know, it all adds to the scope of things. You know, if we can, I like your approach of. You know, you seem real objective, and you're willing to take in a lot of people's opinions and ideas. And you know, I'm not as much that way, I guess. So I think it's good though, because you can learn something from everyone. And I think you're heading in the right direction, man. Putting this all together.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think you know, the skeptics. The more skeptics we have, the healthier we'll be. You know, I think we should have skeptics. I think it's a healthy part of our research. You know, I'm a big fan of a couple of skeptics that I showcase on my website all the time, Brian Dunning and also Sharon Hill, who
nice.
Both are Bigfoot skeptics, but. They've got a healthy approach to it. You know, I think they hold our feet to the fire, and I think that's important. I don't want everybody to agree. I just want everybody to listen, you know.
Great point.
Yeah, well said. I mean, I've become more skeptical and sometimes cynical just because of all the hoaxing and stuff, but I believe in the possibility of existence, and I just need to see something more tangible, on a personal level. But, you know, it's always fascinated me, and the mystery is intriguing. And it's, you know, I don't know if we'll solve the mystery in my lifetime or we could solve it tomorrow. But,
well,
like you say,
you know,
it's going to take people working together.
They have said that the 2013 was the year of Sasquatch, or what was
right.
supposed to be, you know.
Right.
I really... In my heart and opinion, I think 2014 is going to be I'm not saying it's the year of a Sasquatch or Bigfoot, but I think it's going to be a much bigger year of leading the way to proving the existence of Sasquatch. And I hope to be personally a part of that, and I hope to, you know, maybe have a hand or a dip in that, you know. And, Guy,
I
know...
I got to come out where you guys are. You guys are in the centrifuge.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got some ideas.
The heart of Bigfoot.
I got some ideas and thoughts on the process here, and I got some areas that I think are very plausible in proving the existence of Sasquatch, but I need help, and you know, I hope to get a group that can join us or me, you know, in doing this, but. You know, there's lots of Shanes out there trying to do the same thing. So, you know, Guy, I hope you can come out with me sometime, and maybe, you know, Cliff can join me or whatnot. You know, and
absolutely. You know, well, I think that's one of the things I think that not only is Bigfoot in our backyard, but the people that we've met, you and I have met, Shane. I think everybody's heart is in the right place as far as, you know, doing this research and being able to listen to everybody. You know, I think we're kind of lucky that the local community here is a little bit more friendly and a little bit more open than other communities out there.
Right, right. You know, I've been seriously blessed since I moved up here to the Pacific Northwest, and I met you and Cliff and a lot of people up here. So we'll see what happens, Guy. But, you know, I think we're down to our last minute here, so... want to really, thank you for joining us and, speaking your piece and just giving us a real insight into your world and just your thoughts, man, because you're really respected among the community. So, and with me personally. So thank you.
Thanks,
yes,
Johnny.
Thanks, buddy.
You're a great host. I really appreciate being on the show tonight.
Thanks, man, and thanks, everyone, for joining us in the chat room. We'll see you next Sunday.
Thanks, all.